Greetings, everyone. You're with Norm Schultz, Chalmer Wren, and I'm Nick Erkus. This is the Mile High Sanity Project, and you're in it. Greetings, everybody. Welcome back to the Mile High Sanity Project, and it has finally come, the time. The final episode of Cosmos, a space-time odyssey. And who's afraid of the dark? Ain't no one afraid of the dark. This episode, Unafraid of the Dark. I'm here with Norman Schultz.
Good evening. I'm here or morning or whenever it is that you're listening. I always say good morning or good evening, but who the hell knows when people are listening to this, right?
You can just
good
do the
day.
Right. Good day. Good day.
Good day, listeners.
Gotta be careful how you say that, though. Could mean, like, you want them to go.
I said good
day, sir.
In a case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Nice.
Well, everyone, we made it through the entire cosmos.
Hey, Chalmer is here, too.
That's right. I got interrupted. Chalmer, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing good. I feel a little invisible, but I'll get past it.
Well, as long as we don't have you reading something that we'd said interesting, as long as Norm says nothing interesting ever, we should be okay.
Well, we both know that won't happen.
Doomed to failure. This episode, guys, I got to say, I mean, I don't know how you felt, Norm, rebounding from last week's where you felt a little tepid about the reception of it, but...
Loved it.
Yeah, I think this might be my favorite episode. It's hard to say.
Best episode ever.
I have mixed feelings about it.
Really?
Particularly as it pertains to dark energy and dark matter.
I liked that material.
I did too. I guess my problem with it is that I already understood a lot of it. My gap in knowledge has to do with the means by which it is measured and understood, or the evidence that it exists. And aside from a cursory explanation, I've never really had a thorough explanation as to how... all I ever really hear is, well, there just seems to be too much mass. It's like, well, how do you determine that?
Well, they talk about it a couple of ways, and they're...
They do. They talk about standard candles and all that, but...
That's kind of how it's done, though. I mean,
there's problems there, too. Like, what is a standard candle? And I'm finding that I've spent, probably 4 or 5 hours roaming around on Google just trying to understand how this process works, and I still don't.
Well, let's
sign it together.
Let's get into it
then, because they do mention how the standard candles work. I mean, here's the problem overall with dark matter is that dark matter is just a code word for we don't know what this is.
Yeah, and you know, I want to get to that when it comes time.
We'll talk about it later.
But my initial reaction is what you're talking about to me is a strength of the show, because the purpose of this episode was to, you know, basically sum up what science is able to accomplish and sum up where a few of the limits of science currently are to inspire people to get involved, basically. That's how I saw the episode.
I get that.
If it stimulates someone like you with, you know, a decent amount of science background to do research, and after, you know, several hours of researching, you are still puzzled to me, then the episode worked.
True.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that.
And they've achieved their objective. I mean, what I loved about this episode is that it was a nice way of kind of re-emphasizing what the entire point of the series was, just the idea of wanting to stimulate scientific knowledge and kind of thirst to know, and also to point out that it's okay not to know.
Yeah.
I don't know is a perfectly acceptable answer.
Yep.
And I made a little note there. I mean, like, you know, this whole Unafraid of the Dark, it's all about knowledge, about what we know versus the dark of not knowing. It's okay to be unafraid of the dark. It's not a problem, science.
Makes me think back to Socrates, the story that you guys are familiar with Socrates being proclaimed as the smartest man in Athens.
Ah, yeah.
And the reason why he's the smartest man in Athens is because he knows that he doesn't know a lot of stuff. Whereas a lot of other people think they know things, but they actually have no reason to think that. So in his known ignorance, that is what makes Socrates the smartest man.
That's true. Well, you know, speaking of that, the show opens up. Oh, by the way, before we go further, you know, I don't know if you caught this, Chalmer. This episode was directed by Andren herself.
And I saw that. It's her directorial debut, right?
If it is, then it's a fantastic debut in my estimation. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, this episode by far, I wrote down the most just direct quotes that I liked out of it. I mean, there were a lot of other episodes I found very quotable as far as, like, you know, the stuff that they had Neil saying as he was hosting it, but this, all over the place. This episode opens up back in Alexandria, in the Library of Alexandria. Tomber, do you recall in the original Cosmos, Carl Sagan walks through the Library of Alexandria also?
Yes, he does.
Yeah, I just it reminds me of a few Facebook posts that I've seen where I've usually accompanied by some picture or whatever where someone says, does it mean that I'm a geek that I'm still angry about the Library of Alexandria?
Well, I remember...
never forget!
When I was first kind of getting into science and education and all that, I remember reading about this. I don't remember if it was in class or separate, but I remember getting there and going, God damn it!
Yeah, son of a bitch!
Fuck!
I can't believe those assholes!
I was so upset that... just even now thinking about it, there's so much lost.
Yeah.
So much lost.
Sure.
And this is, it's interesting, just the things we know went on there. I mean, Neil kind of talks about it. You know, basically, one of the guys there, geography was invented there. So the size of the Earth was accurately estimated there. Euclid set forth the foundations of geometry. I think they said, that was in use, that book was in use for over 2,000 years?
Yeah.
The Bible, a lot of the Bible was translated there, the translation from Greek. So a lot of stuff, it's interesting, the stuff that still survived given its complete destruction, and I'm also bummed out about it. It's just, you know, of all, like, the cool historical things that we've built throughout the ages, a place dedicated to knowledge and understanding and learning, why did that have to go?
Yeah.
Yeah, and would you think, though, of Neil saying, you know, look, this library, all of the information that it possibly had is, like, just a fraction of what's available right now. Like, Chalmers, you were Googling stuff earlier today. Think of how much more information we have access to.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, but I want to say one thing that he mentions before he talks about the Internet. He said that the Greeks... that was the Romans at the Library of Alexandria, right? Why am I getting this mixed up?
Well, it was
named after Alexander, who conquered it a 100 years earlier. Alexander was Greek.
Yeah.
So, yeah, excuse me, it's the Greeks. as a society, that he said never in history has a government spent so much of their gross product on the acquisition of knowledge. And I thought that was a poignant kind of dig at us.
I like what he said after that. And he goes, and it paid off.
Big time. That was a classic Neil deGrasse Tyson thing to say. I mean, the way that we fund research here in the United States and the meager amount that we do fund research through tax dollars, and the way it is politicized, for example, with our problems of funding stem cell research for religious reasons, etc. It's a mess, and a country of our stature has no business not funding the sciences and research at the levels that are currently funding them. It's a real shame, and I thought that was a reference to us.
Not only that, you know, Chalmer, you talk about, like, the show you usually do, Alternatives to Thought. How many things in America are held up as far as funding science because of strange conspiracy theories that seem to surround it?
Oh, yeah. It's not so much – I don't know if it's held up. I would say that the holdup is political, and it has to do with the sort of – Well, it's very much related to the moral Christian ideology of our government. And I wouldn't say actually Christian. It's, you know, this idea of stem cell research, abortion laws, all of that is ideological.
Right.
And it's not necessarily related to pseudoscience purely in that the public believing in pseudoscience doesn't directly affect the funding. I mean, these people vote, so that matters, but... a lot of it has to do with the goals and image of the people involved in making those decisions. And a big part of it's also money. The School of Mines, which is very nearby, is I think they call it the Harvard of the West. They get tons of funding from the oil industry.
Sure.
Because it's a school that deals with geography and mining and things like that.
Geology, yeah.
Geology. And so they're looking at, you know, where can we drill for oil? Where can we find oil? So they get tons of funding there. They get more funding than I ever knew academia got. But you go and you look at funding for alternative means of solar cell energy conversion, like polymer-based and other things like that. The funding is vastly inferior. And it's simply because there isn't a vested interest. And then you get to other things like stem cell research, where not only is the vested interest is actually completely covered by the ideological prerogative. So it I don't know. There's a lot of fucked up things about it. It really just kind of depends.
There's a really good article in Scientific American back to 2001 talking about science funding and the way that it's not functioning properly, partially for what you're talking about, that it brings in private funding too much and that it's labyrinthian to apply. We should post a link to this so that people can read this for themselves.
Do you know what the state of scientific funding is in other countries, like in Europe and United Kingdom? Are they doing better as far as how they fund it, or do they have the same problems just to different degrees?
I think it's my impression. I know this indirectly, so don't kind of hold me to this, but I believe that there are some societies that value science more than others. So, for example, France and Germany, I believe that they use a fair amount of their tax dollars to fund science and technology. But other societies, even European societies, like the Spanish and even the Netherlands, that they do not fund science as much. So it's kind of a cultural thing.
And there's other issues there, too. Say France puts more money into science. We're talking about a much smaller country with a lot less universities. So in terms of their actual scientific power on a global scale, it would actually be less than in America, because total funding is billions and billions and billions of dollars less, even if it's a greater proportion of gross domestic product or something like that.
Sean, I think you meant to say billions and billions.
Billion. And the other issue, go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to say, it's my understanding that China does not fund science very well either, that mostly they fund industry.
Almost exclusively. It's actually scary. They are an example of the worst possible implementation of engineering and science. A complete disregard for safety, a total yielding to vested interest. The Chinese academic atmosphere is almost disgusting. It's actually pretty bad.
It's almost as disgusting as their actual atmosphere. Have you seen pictures of Beijing? You can't even
see. At least, and very much related.
I actually read an article about a year ago for my environmental law class about how like it's possible that the air around Beijing just may never be able to be cleaned at this point. Like, it's just too much. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. They've polluted a lot of their rivers. When you see people, you see jokes kind of Asian people on the internet riding buses with all these, with gear on and oxygen tanks. And, you know, I can't blame them. I would probably do the same thing in their position, because their environmental safety is non-existent.
Exactly. I don't want to tell people how to live, but if you need a self-contained underwater breathing apparatus to go to work, you might want to dial it down a bit.
There's also, having worked in academia with a lot of people from China, the general view of the Chinese graduate and college academic atmosphere is that it's a joke. That high school is very, very hard, very strict on math and science. But once you get to college, it's almost the complete opposite. It's not taken very seriously. Hmm. So a lot of students from China transfer over to get their master's and their PhDs in America simply because they don't have much respect for the academic atmosphere in China.
Huh. I believe it. Well, you know, Neil goes next into a thought experiment. This kind of is why, you know, science funding, like the quest for knowledge and trying to answer unknown questions and not being afraid to tackle hard questions is important. What'd you think of Neil's thought experiment, Norm? He says, pick a star. Any star. It's like, maybe that one or that one or that one.
I loved it. And I thought that the you know, the transition from the amount of knowledge that we have access to the thought experiment was actually quite clever in its subtlety. Because at first, you don't see how those two things relate. But in reality, what the show is doing there right from the beginning is saying, okay, think back to the ancient Greeks, and even at the height of their knowledge acquisition, they didn't have access to a fraction of the amount of knowledge that we, you know, insights that we have access to. And still, the amount of things that we don't know is ridiculous. And so this thought experiment is a way of putting the human human outlook into perspective.
Right.
Right. By kind of reversing it on us. I thought it was a great thought experiment.
Yeah, because he says, you know, imagine that there's an intelligent life out there someplace. And those people just believe they have not only all the answers, but they actually believe that they are the center of the universe, that it's all there for them.
Right.
Now, obviously, no one would actually ever think that way. But you know, they say, like, how serious would you take their claim?
Right.
And
that was a shot to both science-minded people and religious persons of the past.
Absolutely.
That was a shot to science-minded people to say, basically, you know, if you think that we have an understanding of the universe, again, pretend that you're an alien species looking at us, you would just think, well, ha, that's how cute. And even more so for people who are steeped in this perspective of the specialness of the human species.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And, I mean, yeah, I guess I have nothing to add there. I mean, like, I had a thought, but then it left my mind.
Did it throw you for a loop?
Yeah, no, what you said was good, and it made me forget what I was thinking of. no, I thought it was a great analogy, and it's important to what I was going to say is, you know, I think so much is like this a misunderstanding of what science is, and I feel like I've heard people criticize science saying, well, science clearly doesn't have all the answers. The answer for a scientist to that is to say, yeah, I know, it's great.
Yeah.
It's awesome. There's still more stuff out there that we can go figure out.
Yeah, it's
awesome.
Really funny when you think about it that people talk about science and not knowing everything as if it's some sort of flaw.
No, yeah, that's awesome about that. That's the good thing about science. That's like a celebrated part of science.
Right.
Again, I think maybe this comes down to like scientists maybe because they're so focused on the science aren't very good at PR.
No.
Maybe that's why you need people like Bill Nye, and you need people like Carl Sagan and Neil deGrasse Tyson. The kind of they're brilliant scientists in their own right, but they're also quite good at interfacing and communicating with the public.
Yeah, you know, I've seen some criticisms of Neil deGrasse Tyson for the fact that he's not that well published. I know Carl Sagan was very well published, and I guess Neil deGrasse Tyson is not. Now, assuming that that's true, I didn't check it. Assuming it's true, I don't give a damn, because that's just not the role that he takes. He's perhaps not interested in adding to the scientific literature. Instead, his role is to be a bridge between the sciences and the public, and raising awareness and dealing with the bigger issues. And I actually would say that that's at least equally worthwhile.
Oh, yeah. Well, Norm, what would you rather be, published in the scientific community or published in a Superman comic? Because that's what Matt Seitzen is. In a Superman comic, Superman goes to the Hayden Planetarium in New York City, and it's Neil's likeness that they use. He even has on his crazy star vest and everything, and he has to help Superman find the galactic remains of Krypton up in the sky.
Okay, you're going to have to put a link to some reference to that that we can add that to the website. And by the way, I want to add a few links to this website as well, not only the Scientific American article, but also actually maybe we should talk about this in the next episode. We are going to do a follow-up to the series to just talk about reactions to it. And I'm looking at an article from the Cato Institute that suggests that the government shouldn't fund science at all.
Hmm.
So I think that we should take a look at some of these.
From the Institute, Norm, I find that hard to believe. Hard to believe.
I was going to follow up your comment, Norm, about publishing, and just say I think there's a little bit of White Tower self-delusion. Or sorry, Ivory Tower White Delusion. Or
no need for the word white in there.
Ivory Tower self-delusion.
There we go.
There's my latent racism coming in. Ivory Tower self-delusion with the idea that the publishing process is this pristine indicator of scientific validity.
Right.
And it really is – there are a lot of ways to assess the quality of literature, and there's a lot of shit literature, to be perfectly blunt.
Look, I still believe in peer review and all
that. I do too.
But
– if it's done.
Yeah. But well. Look, I'm sympathetic to someone who doesn't want to publish. I only have a master's degree in philosophy, and I've decided to go a different direction with my life. I enjoy philosophy quite a lot. I didn't want to pursue a PhD. One of the big reasons why I didn't want to pursue a PhD is because I just don't think that it's terribly interesting to me to publish the style of philosophy and the style of work that is done in the journals. And part of that might be that I don't think that I'm up to the task because it's really hard.
Yeah.
But part of it, I think, is that if you look at journal articles, you'll find that, you know, only 1 in 20 or 1 in 30 or maybe even larger than that is actually, you know, kind of interesting, is actually saying something, at least in philosophy. That might not be true in the sciences. In the sciences, I suspect that each of them is dealing with a minute area of science that really only specialists in the field are going to recognize how that fits into the puzzles that they're working on, and whether it's, you know, really something that is groundbreaking or any of that. That for the vast majority of us, we would not only not understand the article, but not understand the significance of the article.
Well, I've kind of realized that doing research for this podcast in general is I have a very I like to go to the source and find the original data, the original publications. And I found that in a lot of cases, what they actually did or what their place is in the literature isn't reflected so much in the literature itself, simply because I don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Yeah. Medical journals, I think, are a little bit better. I can understand them. I don't know if it's a cultural thing. But science journals, I've found – you know, I find reading Scientific American to be very challenging. I have not seen a magazine of Scientific American that I can understand every article. Usually there are several articles that are over my head.
No, but that's a good thing.
It is, but it's a real problem. Science has become so specialized and so erudite that it is understandably out of reach for a lot of people, even science-minded, fairly educated people. I think that, you know, it's difficult to understand the significance of this stuff. So I have no problem whatsoever with someone, if it's true that Neil deGrasse Tyson isn't that well published, I have no problem with someone who chooses not to and chooses to do what he's doing. Absolutely no problem at
all. Well, not only that, I mean, like, you know, what he is doing, I mean, helping to, like, you know, kids go to that. How many kids go to that Hayden Planetarium, or how many kids get to see him on YouTube now, or people like Bill Nye? That's important.
Yeah.
Those are the next people who are going to be inventing the next generation of science and discovering, you know, these next things. So it's equally important.
Everybody plays a role, right? The person who is doing a research on globular clusters or a specific globular cluster determining, the gravitational relationship between the bodies in it, that might not be terribly interesting to us. And we might not be able to understand the significance of it, or if it is significant. But that person is playing an important role that you can't just say, no, we shouldn't be doing that, as well as people like Neil deGrasse Tyson, who aren't doing that kind of hardcore specialized research, but are instead kind of stirring the pot for everybody else.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, no, go ahead, Jomar.
It's it's really important to have that transition or communication from science to the lay public, because even in literature publication, one of the things that you try to do is be as short-worded and concise as possible, because you pay by the page. The more ink you want to put in, the more you have to pay. And that dips into funding. It dips into all kinds of things.
Crazy.
And so you're being brief and highly technical. And the idea that someone exists to translate that in a meaningful way, in a way that's not misunderstood or convoluted like we see with sort of the New Age physics, is extremely important.
Yeah.
Because they sift out the significance of it, which is not always clearly stated in the literature itself.
Yeah, and you know what? Speaking of me personally, I'm on board. I'm personally on board in that I'm changing what I've been doing, teaching philosophy, and I'm going to end up in the science classroom. And I'm not going to be a specialist, and I'm probably not going to be particularly good or better than other science teachers at understanding the science itself. As a matter of fact, early on, I imagine that I'm at a bit of a disadvantage. But I believe that I will be good at inspiring people to see how learning this stuff actually changes the way you live your life and changes the way you make decisions about all kinds of things. Understanding the scientific method, broadly speaking, and that it's really not fancy. It's really not something for specialists. It's really not just a career. It can be just an outlook on our world, a way of determining what you have a right to say you know, and whether you have to say again that we don't know, and all the points in between.
Right. It's a process, Norm. It's a way of thinking. And here's my question for you. As a teacher, what kind of globe are you going to have in your classroom? Because all teachers got to have a globe. Now, if you want to go old school, you can use Martin Behaim's globe from 1492. But the problem is there are only three continents on it, and that was the next place that Cosmos took us. I don't even know if I've ever seen a picture of that globe before. Have you guys?
I have not.
It was another beautiful way, Norm, of illustrating our lack of knowledge right there with another analogy where he's like, imagine this globe. This was the most advanced globe in 1492. It only had three continents on it. He knew infinitely more about his world than we know about our universe, is what Neil says.
Right.
And it just kind of harkens back to what you were saying earlier about the amount of stuff that we don't know.
Right. I like that idea. I don't know if I would have a globe. I'd be afraid of students messing with it. But I think I'd definitely be interested in putting up some sort of old world map of the world, or maybe one of those ancient Greek maps that shows Atlantis.
You're right.
Something to make a similar message. I think that's a great idea.
Well, admittedly, I was fishing for a segue here. So a more abrupt one. Hey, 1912, Victor Hess and his hot air balloons over Austria. How about that guy, huh?
Crazy. Crazy dude.
He went 3 miles near. I'm not like terrified of heights, but I would say I'm uncomfortable in like situations where I don't feel secure. And the wobbliness of a balloon, I think, would really freak me out. And going up 3 miles into the air, I think I would have to go ahead and check the no box, like the not interested.
Yeah, that's half the elevation of jetliners.
No, thank you.
In a hot air balloon. In, the early 20th century.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. I didn't even know. I didn't even realize how high you can go back then in a balloon. I mean, it's not like he didn't have oxygen up
no.
there with him. I mean, he was just like lightheaded probably.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. And what's interesting is what he was trying to figure out is because right around the early 1900s, we had discovered radioactivity.
Right.
I believe. Right. And now, Chalmers, do you know what was the first? Was it like studying things like, uranium that first let us discover radioactivity here on the ground anyways?
The first discovery of radioactivity, that I'm not actually sure.
The discovery or study? Because Madame Curie obviously was the first person who studied it. Did she discover it?
Well, she discovered uranium, right? Or like that's property like that? I'm always a little fuzzy on that. What was interesting is Victor Hess, or like people were finding radiation in the air too. not just around here, not just things on the ground. They were finding, you know, the air seemed to be irradiated also. And that's what he was testing in his balloons. He was trying to see, is whatever is doing that coming from the sky, coming from above the earth? And that's what he was testing. So he would go up in his hot air balloon. He would take it must have been some kind of Geiger counter, I suppose. And they were measuring the radiation levels up there. And he found that the radiation up at that level was about over two times higher than the ground level.
And it couldn't have been a Geiger counter. And this is actually where I think that things get sloppy in calling radioactivity what it is. Because I don't believe that cosmic rays register on Geiger counters. Geiger counters register protons, don't they? Or excuse me, neutrons.
I believe so.
So the neutron decay is only one form of radioactivity. Other forms of radioactivity don't involve...
Well, hang on. That's not right.
What's
not? Because I've used a Geiger counter for X-rays before.
Measured X-rays?
Yeah, a Geiger counter would measure gamma rays, actually.
How is that possible?
It looks for ionizing radiation.
Right, but X-rays would be a constant, right?
In terms of the interstellar, or in terms
of it's a true wave
versus
it's a true wave. Whereas emitting a neutron, or a neutron, would be an actual billiard ball.
So
Geiger counter, you always hear the ticks, right?
Right, which indicates the hits. So this is kind of odd. I'm just going to read what I found. A Geiger counter is used for measuring ionizing radiation, and then it says it detects radiation such as alpha particles, beta particles, and gamma rays.
Huh, it detects all three.
So an alpha particle is a clump of protons and neutrons. It's essentially a helium atom.
Right.
So that makes sense.
Minus the electron.
It's still radiation, but gamma rays are very, very high energy light waves. So
right.
And
X-rays
sure.
are just radio waves at the high end of the spectrum, right?
Yeah.
So I don't get it. Hey, this continuing with this episode, admitting right. stuff we don't know. I don't understand it.
No.
The best that I understood was that the similarity between them is they are kind of expressed like a particle. The clump of energy being released ends up being expressed as if it's a particle.
We need to ask a physicist.
Still don't get it.
Norm, we need to ask a physicist episode badly, I think.
Yes. Yes, we do.
Well, here's one of the things that...
We've lost Chalmer now. He's down the rabbit hole.
Sorry. There. So, okay. Yeah, a Geiger counter basically detects ionization events. It uses a gas. I don't exactly see how. I'm going to close the page, so I don't... trail off into silence for the next hour.
Yeah.
It's so easy to do this, isn't it?
It is.
I don't understand that either. I mean, something being ionized, doesn't that happen with charged particles all the time? I mean, I don't get it.
Not so.
So ionization is kind of a general term whenever you create
a charge imbalance between the nucleons and the electrons.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily between the nucleons and the electrons. That's typically how it's used in solution chemistry or applied chemistry.
Oh, it could be any imbalance in charge.
Right, but ionization can occur whereupon the formation of an ionic species forms. So that can occur...
That's a circular definition right there, my friend.
So, for example, you knock a chunk of something out of a nucleus, and it's positively charged. You've created an ion.
Right.
So it's not necessarily that you're just knocking off electrons. You can kind of go from the inside out and...
Sure. No, that makes sense. Adding electrons, you create an ion as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, what I appreciated in them talking about... how thorough Victor Hess was back then. Like maybe it's the sun that's causing this.
You can imagine someone doing this, right? Well, you know, let's speculate. Where is all this energy coming from? I wonder if it's coming from up there. Well, I guess we got to go up there. What?
And he goes up there and it is. He's like, well, maybe it's coming from the sun up there.
Crazy. Just a very kind of direct, practical, like, hey, let's do it kind of attitude.
And he went up at night and the levels were still high.
Yep.
Even at night. So I mean, it was
a real balloon ride during a solar eclipse. As a side note, can you imagine how freaking awesome that would be?
That would be very cool.
I just was in awe at the idea of that. And I thought that the way they animated it was really cool.
Yeah, that was awesome. I mean, just the idea of that, of just, you know, I would just like to be in the balloon just to see the eclipse, that he was actually doing science at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. How would you remember? But have you guys been up in a hot air balloon before?
No.
I've not. It's on my bucket list.
Ah, Laura and I have. It's a lot of fun. Even if you're afraid of heights, I'm pretty afraid of heights, and it was a blast. Because it's really gradual, and you feel quite safe. And it's just, it's really nice experience.
Well, Neil looked like he was having fun. They had the little shot of Neil on the balloon. Yeah. You know, next they go forward in time about 20 years or so. It's 1933, and Fritz Zwicky. This guy is he's relatively unknown, and it's crazy considering how much incredible stuff he just either discovered or named.
Yeah.
Got the names of some awesome stuff.
And let's make sure that we first talk about his relationship to the what's going on with cosmic rays. And to be honest, I think I missed that. I can't remember the transition between Victor Hess studying cosmic rays and Fritz Zwicky.
Well, cosmic rays are from other stars, right? He was the first person who first understood how a giant star dies.
Okay, so cosmic rays are from the total number of supernova.
Right. He actually coined the term supernova.
Yeah.
He also coined the term. Because he was one of the first people who understood how a big star dies, he understood, he did the math, he understood that, you know, some of them might collapse and become black holes, but some of them might be a type of star that's, shooting off, you know, the pulsar, he didn't call it a pulsar, though. He called it a neutron star. He also coined that term.
Right. Well, a neutron star and a pulsar are the same thing. A pulsar is just a neutron star that is rotating in such a way that it spits out X-rays in a particular in our direction regularly, or I forget. Gamma ray, I forget. Yeah.
I don't know if it's gamma or X-ray, but yeah, it pulses at a constant rate based on its rotation.
I imagine that some of the neutron stars that we know about are actually pulsars, but they're just not facing our direction.
But it kind of made it sound like that it's an interchangeable, like more like the modern term for them is called pulsar.
Right.
And I don't know if like there's different levels of it has to be spinning a certain, it has to be like a certain strength of a pulsar or of a neutron star in order to pulse.
Right.
That I don't know. I know that they spin ridiculously fast. One of the things I love Neil saying, you know, it's one of the things that he loves about science, that we don't have to pretend to know all the answers. And that was at that point there. I mean, the idea, one of the things that Zwicky also observed was the gravity around these giant clusters of galaxies. It's like a lens. It warps and distorts space. You can see an image of a galaxy behind that cluster. Have you ever seen pictures of a gravitational lens? It's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very cool.
Yeah.
It's weird. Because when you look at it, it seems like you're kind of looking through a lens. But it's actually a physical phenomenon. That's the true image presenting itself to the camera.
Yeah.
And that kind of blows my mind.
Kant would be very happy because he would be saying, you see, we are not seeing the way things actually are. We are seeing things partially because of the way we are.
Yep.
So I don't know if I agree with that. In a roundabout way, we are kind of seeing the way things are in a very indirect manner. It has nothing to do with our limits of observation. The anomaly in the observation is innate in the physical qualities of the universe.
The point is that the way light behaves, it is not 100% indicative of the source.
True.
That's the point.
Well, not only that, Norm, but you said because of the way we are, our position in space relative to that gravitational lens also is going to play into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sort of thing is awesome. And that right there is a piece of evidence for dark matter and dark energy. And I believe that I didn't realize that Zwicky was the one who maybe is he the first person who observed this or predicted it? Because I always thought that Einstein also predicted. I mean, he predicted that the gravity of like a curve. He predicted that space would be curved. And so, like, it's not unexpected that we would find these gravitational lenses. I always connected that idea, though, more to Einstein.
I don't know the answer to that. I wouldn't be surprised if they both speculated about this. I don't think did Fritz Zwicky coin the term dark matter? I don't think he did.
No, I don't think so.
I think he just observed that these galaxies don't behave this way and then proposed that there must be some form of matter that we're not able to see that is responsible for it, or some other source of gravitational attraction or something.
Well, speaking of the galaxies, what he was looking at was a cluster of galaxies called the Coma Cluster. And he was looking at it and observing it, and he sees this thing. We can look by looking at the galaxies and measuring their speeds, you can measure the mass. If you do some Newtonian physics there, and he's seeing how fast they're moving, and he says they're going way too fast. They should be flying apart,
right?
But something, for some reason, is keeping them gravitationally bound. But we can't see it. There's nothing there. That's kind of in history where the first idea of dark matter comes from, is we're looking at something that we can't see. And it's having an effect. And this was confirmed later. This is another thing I just love about science. It was confirmed in the 1970s. Vera Rubin, she's studying the Andromeda Galaxy. Did you like that section, Norm, where they just talked about the spin of the galaxies? That's something I didn't know it or didn't remember.
Just
it.
Inspiring. She sees that the way that the galaxy is, what, Andromeda first? The way it is spinning is not the way you would expect at all. If you're just looking at the gravitational effect of the bodies there.
Right. Well, and you talk about it from a Newtonian physics point of view. They show Mercury, and they show how Mercury is going around the sun way faster. You also hear this a lot of times in physics, thought experiments to say, think of the figure skater who, you know, whenever they have their arms out, they spin slow. Whenever they bring their arms in close to their body, they speed up. They spin really fast.
Right. And so you would expect that with a galaxy. But you don't see that. Instead, you see the outermost stars are traveling at about the same speed as the innermost stars, and that makes no sense. And so what I really liked about the way it was presented is Neil says, so, you know, she must have said, well, that's funny, and maybe there's something weird. There's got to be something weird about Andromeda. So let's check out other galaxies. And she checked out 60 galaxies and found the exact same thing in all of them.
Yeah.
And what I thought, you know, what I told you, Nick, when we were talking about this is, in a way, it's kind of amazing that other people hadn't noticed this. But, you know, you were right in saying, well, somebody's going to notice it for the first time, you know, so.
Yeah, and I just wrote down, I mean, I love that, you know, Zwicky was considered a little crazy for his ideas.
Right.
You know, and then they had to be cooperated with, you know, independent observational evidence years later by someone.
Yeah.
This is how science works.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just part of, you know, I wrote down in my notes, we're expanding our globe. You know, it's getting bigger. We're realizing what we don't know. And what we don't know by doing some math is that dark matter makes the universe nearly 10 times more massive than we can see.
Yeah.
And that's kind of creepy and weird to think about. It's like we look out there and all this stuff that we can see. We're all star stuff, all that stuff, everything.
And there's a lot of it that we don't know.
We can't even see it.
Yeah.
So real quick, Einstein did first propose the gravitational lensing. Zwicky did not appeal to it in regards to nebulae until almost 20 years later.
Huh. What do you know?
I thought so. Okay, that's just where my mind always is. But yeah, the entire idea of dark matter blows my mind apart a little bit. I think it blows everyone's mind apart because it's really kind of, you know, if people are wondering where are some of the frontiers in physics and astronomy, this is it. They're looking for ways to try and detect what this stuff is and figure it out. We have no idea right now.
Yeah, and you know, as far as just off the top of my head, if you wanted to actually study dark matter, to me, the two ways that I can think of is one, to actually go out there and try to find some, which that prospect doesn't sound plausible yet. Or two, find some other way that it is emitting some sort of signature. There's talk of being able to read gravitational waves the way we read like radio waves or, you know, light.
That
basically can allow you to create an image. And if it's actually got mass, then you should be able to, over distance, be able to, quote-unquote, see it. So it's my understanding that this is something that they are just started to be able to do. And
there was a recent, very controversial publication.
Right, right. And so, you know, if we get better at that, then nothing, anything that has mass will be in our view. Of course, then we'll start to find out that there are this stuff out there that doesn't necessarily have mass that we don't know about. And there's some other implication, right? There'll be a, for more you learn, you tend to find out the more things that you don't know. But
yeah, and that's the whole point of this episode. I mean, again, it's something else that you just said, Norm, we might not have to go out there to find it because we're in the universe. It might be around us everywhere, and we just don't know how to measure it. I mean, there are people who are trying to one thought is that maybe dark matter is made up of, you know, they call them WIMPs, like weakly interacting massive particles.
Right.
So they hardly interact ever with ordinary matter. You know, in the long run, over, you know, the long haul, there's enough of it that it can overwhelm gravity. But in theory, it's everywhere. So right now, if those people are right and it is, you know, the WIMP is what the turns out to be what that is, you're talking about it's everywhere. It's coming through us right now, everywhere.
Right.
So you can, there are places where they, you know, they use those, like, you know, like abandoned mine shafts where they, you know, go way underground. They set up those detectors to try and find see if they can, you know, capture or get hit, have some, you know, really, like, I don't know what kind of, Chalmers, do you know what kind of materials that they use in their, in like their detectors that they're trying to set up? They have stuff that they're hoping would interact with those particles and have a better chance of it. But I mean,
it's for gravitational waves or detectors to interact with particles associated with dark matter?
Dark matter particles.
I don't know if they're trying to actually make anything. As far as I know, the theory regarding dark matter is pretty, a lot of it's speculative.
Yeah.
So if they're building anything, it's based on a speculative hypothesis.
Yeah. And that's all this stuff is, again, it's all frontier, very speculative. I mean,
they have confirmed the existence of it.
Yeah.
The existence of it is not speculative.
No. Like well, we know
what it is and how, where to go from here is speculative.
Yeah. I mean, I think I heard one of the ways they were thinking of trying to detect it might be to have, like, way underground, you have some kind of substance, and I can't remember what it was that they were using, what element, that is cooled to almost as close as you can get it to absolute zero. So there's almost no molecular motion in it. And that if something hits, anything hits that mass inside of it, in theory, you would register a little bit of a heat increase because of the impact.
Oh, so you're detecting it thermodynamically. That actually is kind of a cool idea.
Hmm. Yeah, and again, like, it's one of those things where, like, you know, the scientists are like, we're really excited, and people are like, well, it worked. Like, we have no idea. Probably not. And they're still, you know, still trying to do it. It's fun, though. It's a cool idea. Next here was maybe my favorite analogy, speaking of all this dark matter, and this is all so far to say nothing of dark energy. We'll get to that in a minute, but the great analogy, Chalmers, what would you think of that, of Neil at night, kind of at dusk, he's standing on the shore of the ocean.
Yeah.
He said it's like kind of like standing on the ocean at night and thinking that the foam from the wave was the entire ocean. And that's kind of like what our universe is like.
Because that's all you can see.
Right, because you're looking through. And this is the issue I have with dark matter and dark energy is that we're looking through so much dust and unknown, and it's very fuzzy. But dark energy sort of represents, and dark matter sort of represents the force behind the wave of kind of an unknown nature. It's mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling. I mean,
I thought that analogy was awesome.
It's a great analogy.
It's better the second time you watch the show when you're actually your radar is on, forgetting the analogy, when he's first standing there and you're looking at the waves, then you really get it.
What it reminds me of is Plato's cavern.
The cave,
where you see the world in shadows, sure. But you can never actually look out of the cave and see what makes the shadows.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as well, I mean, I'm not going to get sidetracked by this analogy because that is probably my favorite thing that Plato wrote, his allegory of the cave.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And the way it applies to knowledge, I think, is just awesome. I mean, it, you know, smart guy. I'll get lost in that if I go down that hole. I love them saying it, like, you know, everything, all the stuff in the cosmos is about 5% of what it's actually made of. Isn't that crazy?
It's crazy.
Yeah, this isn't a subtle effect. This is the fuel of the universe.
Yeah. Right. And again, the answer is we have no idea what it is.
Yeah.
Just completely no idea at all. I mean, as baffling as dark matter seems to be, dark energy is even, I mean, it's hard to even wrap your head around what we don't know.
I mean, how do you study something other than mass, right? How do you study something that just absorbs every other form of energy, right? I mean, there are things that absorb radio waves, obviously things that absorb light rays, that's dark, right?
Yeah.
So the term dark is a reference to things that you can't see. Technically, you cannot see the color black. Can you imagine some body out there that just absorbs all the entire electromagnetic spectrum? How would you be able to see it?
Well, I would say it's kind of the opposite for dark matter in that it doesn't appear to absorb anything. It's invisible except for its indirect interaction. Energy goes right through it. If it absorbed everything, we wouldn't be able to see galaxies across the solar or across the universe, right?
I don't understand what you're saying.
So it doesn't absorb anything.
Oh, it would block our view?
Right, it would block photons.
It doesn't absorb photons. It doesn't interact with normal matter, save for this transient gravitational force.
Well, how do you know
light
it doesn't?
Light passes right through it, right?
Light passes through it? How do we know that?
Because if it got absorbed by it, we wouldn't see. The light wouldn't reach our eyes.
Huh? I'm missing something.
So the problem with dark matter, the reason we can't study it, is that it does not interact with, except for through this transient gravitational force, it does not interact with any of the known particles or measurable particles or forms of radiation in any way that we can see. It doesn't appear to distort light, save through a gravitational.
It just clicked.
Yeah,
gotcha.
You see what I mean?
You would be able to see, if it absorbed light, then you would be able to see it, say, passing by some other object, because that object would appear dimmer briefly.
Right. It doesn't ever seem to distort our view.
Right. The way we, for example, the way we see planets and other things, the wobbling effect of the sun, and if it happens to be in line with us, then you actually see a light from a sun flickering because of a planet. The planet is not releasing enough light or electromagnetic energy to see it directly, but you can see it indirectly. What you're saying is if dark matter was what I was proposing, it would have the same kind of interaction, and it doesn't. And that's really what makes it dark. So it's not that it's worse than it absorbs energy, it's that it doesn't even interact at all. That makes sense.
And that's why it's so hard to study it, because it's how do we – we're all made of stuff, and all we have is stuff to use to look at other stuff. And this stuff apparently doesn't interact with stuff.
Well, it's an interesting paradigm in science that in order to poke it with a stick, you need a stick that you can poke it with. And with dark energy, we're waving the stick around, and there's nothing to poke. You know what I mean?
Right.
We don't know how to study it.
Right.
Save through indirect means or through theory and speculation where no one's really sure.
That really is mind-blowing.
It is. Well, you know, Chalmers next is – they talk about the standard candles next, because you know Hubble discovers the universe is expanding. Now, the way that we look at this is we look at certain stars whenever they blow up, you know, certain supernovas are obviously bigger than other ones. So you might have a closer, weaker supernova that looks brighter than one that was, you know, or the opposite, I mean. Like, you know, one that was further away but stronger might appear to be closer. than one that was closer and dimmer. But there's a certain type of star that blows up at the same level all the time everywhere.
And this made sense to me.
Me too.
Because
this is why it's a standard candle. No matter where you observe it in the universe, you know its brightness. The max brightness it gets, we know that.
And the reason is because you're taking a star that wouldn't go supernova at all. It's too small to go supernova.
Right.
But it's because it's in this binary relationship with this other star, and it's stripping material from this other star, it builds up to a point of blowing up. And so it makes sense that there would be a standard point for a star that is too small to go supernova to acquire material to make it unstable. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Other stars that are already running that are of various sizes, them having different different levels of energy of their explosions, that makes sense as well, that you wouldn't be able to judge those. But this, the fact that it reaches a particular threshold, and that's a standard for when it's going to blow up, that makes sense.
Right. And that's why they call them standard candles, just for that. That's a great explanation of it.
The analogy to me, which I'm not sure it's a great analogy for someone who's not science-minded already, but the analogy to me would be understanding that at a certain level on the periodic table, if you keep adding nucleons, you get to a point where they're going to be unstable. And there's a point on the periodic table, that let's say that you were, changing an element by bombarding it, that at a certain point you're going to get something that is now radioactive because you've made it unstable. So if you were looking on the outside and measuring what was going on, and your Geiger counter goes from zero to something, then you know what element you're at. Does that make sense, Chalmer?
It does.
Yep. Same thing.
It's awesome. I love it. I mean, here's again, speaking about this stuff, it's so speculative. We don't know all the answers. And Neil says, it's better to admit our ignorance than to believe answers that might be wrong.
Yeah.
Pretending to know everything closes the door to finding out what's really there.
Right.
And I loved that.
And it's really great, the episode showing how clever we can be and how even despite all that, there's still a tremendous amount of stuff that we don't know.
Oh, yeah. But here's something a little bit it's not all doom and gloom for what we don't know. Here's something that we figured out that blew my fucking mind out of my head. And I think the same for you, Norm. So they're talking about next, the Voyager 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Right? Now, these are the only spacecraft we've sent out of our solar system, or at least one of them. I think Voyager 1 is gone. They said it's passed beyond our sun's heliosphere. So that's the sun. It puts out the solar wind from our sun. It's passed beyond the influence of that.
Right.
Now, when a star blows up, whenever other cosmic rays are hitting our sun's heliosphere, it's always kind of like a force field, so to speak. But if a big explosion happens out there in space, a supernova, it pushes that heliosphere back in towards the sun. The pressure is enough to overwhelm it. A long time ago, about 2 million years ago, a star explodes. Our sun's heliosphere gets pushed back in enough that it goes back beyond closer into itself than Earth's orbit. That means Earth gets bathed in the supernova's explosion, essentially.
Yeah, and just as a side note, it really is amazing to think about just how massive our star is, the sun, because we know about the Earth's magnetosphere and how it shields us to some degree from radiation from the sun, as well as other things. The heliosphere is basically the sun's magnetic sphere, magnetosphere. And right. It normally extends far out into the solar system. What did he say? Normally out to almost Neptune?
Yeah, or beyond, even.
Right.
Yeah.
The heliosphere is beyond Neptune.
Yeah, so think about that. That's the sun's magnetic field.
Yeah.
That is just mind-boggling.
And the largest planet in the solar system, Jupiter, its magnetic field is enormous, but it doesn't extend. It's not astronomical. It's planetary.
Right.
It's
right.
Yeah, it's amazing how huge it is.
And we've discovered stars in the universe that are so big that they go out to Jupiter's orbit, just right. a star.
Right.
So massive is it? I mean, that's, again, it blows my mind to think of. So you might be thinking, well, how the hell do we know any of this? Right?
That's well, a good question. Specifically, how do we know that there was a time a couple of million, or what, 200 million years ago? Did he say?
About 2 million years ago. How can we possibly know that?
And, 2 million. Okay, yeah. That the heliosphere shrank because of bombardment from a nearby supernova. How in the world can we know that? That was a great question.
Right. And the key is these little things called manganese nodules.
Yeah.
Little tiny rocks scattered everywhere over the seafloor. These rocks grow very slowly. And we're talking about a millimeter over a million years slow.
Right.
All right. Now, here's an interesting thing about supernova. It produces a unique type of radioactive iron.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And that, when it's hitting, you know, whenever the heliosphere gets pushed back in, that radiation bathes Earth, a certain amount of iron is irradiated in a certain way that can only possibly happen from that. Researchers found this thin layer of that iron.
Mm-hmm.
It was in a manganese nodule. We know about the rate that they grow.
Right.
They grow in layers. And it's just a matter of, in a sense, counting those tree rings, so to speak.
Right.
Count up the layers.
Reminds me of the layer of iridium that geologists found all over the planet to suggest the bombardment of a particularly large comet or asteroid.
Right.
Yeah.
And think about the kind of scientists who would have been studying this, probably like geologists or someone, right? Or oceanographers or someone. You know, like scientists are looking at a little rock and they end up accidentally discovering the signature of a supernova that happened about 2 million years ago. And that's only probably when those rays hit us. Who knows when the star blew up?
Yeah. And I really loved the way he said that, look, you know, the difference between seeing a pebble and, you know, learning what happened to the heliosphere 2 million years ago is science.
Hey, guys, can we pause real quick?
Sure.
Ashley's about to walk through the door and the birds are just going to go absolutely nuts.
Okay, we're going to pause. All right, and we're back. It was a false alarm, apparently.
Don't even fucking edit it out. I like that. So Chalmers, I was just saying, isn't science fucking awesome? God, this part of the episode is just it just blew my mind out of my head.
Yeah. Well, like Norm was saying, I feel like it's kind of done its job, at least for me. I pulled up most of the original literature from the show, and I'm just like excited to read about it. I have some of the original literature on Geiger counter detection tubes. I have some of the original literature from Victor Hess and just all these things.
Huh.
And I don't know. It gets you excited about learning.
Yeah.
It's amazing. You know, speaking of the Voyager 1 and 2, they next talk about Carl Sagan, how he helped to create the discs that we put on there. Those, like, you know, little hello, how you doing, this Earth.
Just the fact that we have been able to make a device that we could send out in the solar system, building speed as it goes, and then it continue out into deep space and keep in contact with us all along the way, telling us in case it finds it something. Just that is unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. You know, Norm, if you ever check out our Twitter stream, we're following the tweets of some of these spacecraft way out there, and every now and then it tweets how many light hours from Earth it is.
Huh.
Yeah.
And it's awesome.
And I imagine it's going to tweet that and nothing else for a very long time. Right?
Yeah. Basically. Yeah.
Because the odds of it actually running into something are, at this point,
astronomical. Literally. Yeah. It's astronomical. Here's what's cool. I didn't ever understand, you know, looking at that disc, I knew they said that it had Earth's return address. I never really understood how that worked.
Yeah.
And the visual of how they explain it again, I was just, fuck me when I was, okay, so on the disc, We have Earth address via the 14 nearest pulsars.
Yeah.
All right. They use a ticking clock of the hydrogen atom in order to let them know the time signature.
Right. A base unit of time.
Yeah. That is smart.
I want a hydrogen clock.
Did Sagan think of that? That is ridiculously smart to do that.
Who knows?
You talk about an atomic clock. Jesus. It's ridiculous. That thing also should be able to survive out there, they said, for at least about 1 billion years.
Right.
You know, so it's got a little time to – it's just going to be flying out there. It's kind of awesome to think that, you know, who knows 1 billion years from now if there will even be humans. You know, we might – if we're still around, it's probably going to be something else at that point.
Well, the dynamicism of biology is such that whatever there is will simply be an ancestor of humanity.
But this will still be there. Isn't that crazy?
Oh, yeah. It's insane.
Who knows what we'll look like and sound like then? But we have, you know, sounds from Earth from right now on there.
Yep. It's nuts, yeah. Voices, echoes through time.
Seriously.
It's tiny little beings on a tiny mote of dust that just... The data of that noise exists in some arrangement of matter across the universe for billions and billions of years. It's flabbergasting.
Can you imagine getting a Voyager-like probe from another planet?
I hope for it every day.
A plate with recorded sounds of stuff that's going on that planet?
Now, Norm, yeah,
that would be incredible.
Norm, you're a Trekkie. Admit it. Whenever they are talking about Voyager and all the discs and its mission,
Voyager,
return transmit mission.
Yes,
I couldn't help it. Yeah, it's just amazing. I love them speculating, like, you know, like Earth of 1 billion years from now, it might be completely unrecognizable. Those Voyager discs still there.
Yeah,
you know, at this point in the episode, it here's where it gets, you know, the tribute they did to Carl Sagan, I felt, was just amazing.
Pale blue dot.
Yeah. I love the pale blue dot, and they played the whole thing, and I love it. It kind of, you know, brings a tear to your eye to hear him talking about that, to put it in perspective like that. The message that it contains, it's, you know, it's one of those things where I have a hard time thinking that anyone, how could you not hear that and feel humbled?
Yeah, it's what's really stands out to me is how it's completely unacademic. The whole speech is totally sentimental. You could easily break down a picture like this into a very academic sort of description. And he completely disregards that and just appeals totally to humanity. There's no background. There's no warm-up. It's just... The image is in and of itself powerful in its presentation.
Yeah. And the first time anybody had ever seen that, ever had seen, you know, the Earth from that perspective. What a smart thing to have the Voyager do.
Oh, it's incredible. You know, a tiny mote of dust in a sunbeam. Yeah. It's poetic. It's beautiful. I mean, this entire series, it's all kind of a tribute to science and the idea of what it can do. And it's amazing.
It's a human activity. It's not a specialized thing. There's nothing actually very special about it.
It's a process. Anyone can do that. Not only can anyone do this, I think the show is trying to say it's probably better if you try it.
Yeah.
Five simple rules.
Yep.
They talk about. Question authority. All right? Think for yourself.
And I put question authority and think for yourself together.
Maybe it might have been, because they also
initially I had a hard time figuring out, well, wait, which are the five rules?
Me too. Because they also say, you know, they say, question yourself, don't believe anything just because you want it to be true.
Yeah, I think that's two. So I think one is question authority and think for yourself. Those go hand in hand, right? Allowing someone else to think for you, that's an authority. Don't do that. Think for yourself. Now, you know, in practical terms, you do have to take into account the opinion of an expert as counting more than your opinion.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that just because they're an expert that they're automatically right. You could still ought to look for and deserve the evidence and argument for that the positions, right?
And speaking of that, one of the rules, since we can't figure out the number system, was called one of the rules, test ideas with evidence. And this is just something they repeated from the first episode. You follow the evidence wherever it may lead. The ones that pass the evidence test, you accept those ideas. If it fails it, though, reject it.
Yeah, he just says it's wrong, get over it.
Right. You know, and he says, you know, like I think one of the last ones they talked about then was, you know, remember, you could be wrong.
Right.
The easiest person to fool is probably yourself.
Yeah. Be wary of, and this was earlier, but be wary of things that you want to believe, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's what's just so important about the process of science, the scientific method in that way of thinking. It's one of the things I love about philosophy and analytical thinking and reasoning with logic, because it's easy to fool yourself, and it's hard. It's funny. You could think that you're a pretty reasonable person and a pretty as a layperson, you might think, well, I'm a pretty smart person. I used to think that. And it wasn't that I wasn't smart or intelligent, but these rules, if you don't know them and don't employ them and use them, it's easy to find yourself thinking things that either don't make any kind of logical or rational sense or would be unscientific, and you sure can avoid that. That's what the whole point of this is.
Sure.
Again, like probably the most transformative class I took was a logic class. It wasn't called that. It was called Language, Logic, and Persuasion, but it was essentially a logic class.
Right.
And, you know, that totally opened my mind in a way where, you know, I never really considered myself to be a really unreasonable person, but there were some of those rules I realized I do those sometimes.
Right.
I don't realize it.
Sure.
You know, and that sort of thing turns around your entire way of looking at almost everything.
Right.
I found anyways. Like whenever I took that class, my ability to comprehend things increased simply from learning that and learning that method and practicing it a little bit.
Yeah, and science is just an expression. Applied expression of logic, really.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, anyone out there, I mean, I'm sure most of the people who listen to the show are probably, you know, already scientifically accurate or literate to some point like that. But I mean, I don't know. Like, this is why it's important to always stress the idea of something like nolius in verba. Okay. The evidence is out there, the reasons are out there. And there are ways that you could teach yourself to think that really help you to avoid making a mistake, because this whole episode is about what we don't know and about how what we do know might turn out to be wrong anyways.
Right.
So we already have enough working against us without not thinking responsibly. Right?
Right.
This is why it's important to do it.
Right. One of my favorite phrases when I'm debating someone is to tell them what I don't know and also include neither do you.
Right.
Yeah.
It's exactly. Usually pretty poignant when you can tell someone, look, in this subject that we're talking about, let's first look at the boundaries of what is known and what is not. The first thing that I don't know is this, and you don't know that either, by the way.
It's kind of like your answer to someone like a Ken Ham, were you there?
Yeah, no. Sure.
Neither were you.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Science is a way to keep from fooling ourselves. Right. He says that, you know, they say the more science belongs to everyone, the less likely it is to be misused. This is where they're talking about, you know, Neil says, has science been used for, you know, bad things? Of course. You know, has science led to some things like the atomic bombs? Yeah, it has.
Yeah.
And he said that's why it's dangerous, though, to let knowledge be in the hands of an elite few. This is also what this goes back to the beginning. When the Library of Alexandria was destroyed, there was only an elite few who had access to that knowledge, who knew about it. The mob came, and they couldn't. They were overwhelmed by it. They're saying now it's better if we have everyone. The more people who know,
sure,
the better.
There's a lot of talk about the open source movement.
I'm a big fan.
Yeah, and I think that's a very good thing. Democratization. I'm having trouble saying it. Democratization of information, other expressions of this, like with the Tesla company basically giving its statement about how it's going to not enforce its patents, basically take all of our technical insights and use them. Those kinds of attitudes, I think, have a science-minded outlook at their core. Scientists can't get anywhere if they don't collaborate with other people and don't share information openly. And also, it doesn't get anywhere unless your ideas are open to being questioned.
Right.
Anybody can challenge them. And so, you know, I hate to put it this way, but when it comes to figuring out the way the world is, we got to be in it together. We have to be on the same team, so to speak, right? And absolutely. Being on the same team means, you know, temporarily being an adversary to challenge someone. But in reality, you want the same thing, right? And that's one of the things that I really get annoyed at with the difference between a productive debate and an argument. Sometimes I'll get into a debate with someone and it becomes clear that they're not interested in actually learning anything or having their views challenged. They're just making it look like they're justified.
No.
They're not interested in changing their mind. They're not interested in even questioning. And so they're not on the team, right?
Norm, those people aren't philosophers, and I mean that in the truest sense of the word, of what philosophy means, a love of wisdom.
Right.
There are some people who engage in argument because when I do it, and I do it frequently, and I don't do it, as some people might think, just to piss people off. It's about I really truly feel like if I have a good dialogue with someone, that I'll get something out of it.
Yeah.
And they could too.
Sure.
But there are some people, though, who would rather just – their idea of arguing is they get to say – it's their turn to say their side, and then you say your side, and that's it.
Right.
There's no interaction of that. The Venn diagrams don't overlap. You know, that's the problem. I don't like that. That sort of thing is uninteresting to me. There's no point to it.
Well, and the thing that you can say for sure about it is it's just no way to get to know the world. If you're really interested in knowing how the world works – that attitude is counterproductive.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, you should be interested in knowing the world. I mean, the fact that we can know anything about it, you know, as far as we can tell, is awesome.
What else is there to be interested in, really? I have other interests. Like what?
Well, Tom, I've heard that some of human beings like things called sports and whatnot, but
fiction and fantasy, those are entertaining too, but
you can still draw knowledge out of those things too if you really
they rely on a context of reality ultimately. You can't completely deviate from the real simply because it's philosophically impossible. You can't be so abstract that you have no reference to reality.
Yeah, you're unwittingly quoting George Berkeley right now.
Oh, neat.
He proposed the idea that David Hume. He proposed the idea that there's nothing new when it comes to knowledge. You think that nothing is freer than the human imagination and all of the things that we can come up with in our wildest fantasies and stories. But in reality, all we're doing is just combining or subtracting ideas that we already work with. And that led to his view that really everything, all knowledge, comes from root sensory experiences. I was just going to say that view in general has its problems. But for practical purposes, empiricism is correct.
Yeah.
And that there are a few exceptions, so you can't make it a universal statement. But information from our senses is the root of the scientific method. Observation, subjecting it to reason, but the reason is run by the observations, not the other way around. Right. You don't change the observations based on reasoning. You change your reasoning based on the observations. So ultimately, the empiricists, I think, even though they weren't as right as they thought they were more right than they're given credit.
Right. Well, and I've always thought of science as through epistemology as a kind of applied empiricism.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's all it is.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Absolutely. No. I agree. I got to say, I mean, do we want to say this for our next episode a little bit or not? But
we are running long.
this was a fantastic episode. We are running a little long, so I think we could save our overall opinions for what the series has been for the next time. I mean, I think it's, you know,
we're going to have another episode, a full wrap up of our thoughts of the series as a whole, as well as our thoughts about reactions to the series. As in, you know, I want us to talk about how has the scientific community regarded the series. Are there any mistakes in the series? And also, how is the general community accepting it? Including, I want to include some commentary about how some of the more religiously and politically conservative groups have kind of reacted badly to the series.
Like Answers in Genesis and whatnot.
Sure, sure. So we're going to talk about all that, and I'm looking forward to that episode.
Definitely. Me too. And this has been a fantastic series, a fantastic ride. This episode, it's hard for me to pick a favorite. This might be my favorite episode.
It might be mine too.
I think the one that that blew my mind the most, just because of what I learned, was the episode. I can't remember what episode it was. Maybe 6 or 7. Hiding in the Light, where they talk about really the birth of astrophysics by looking at, you know, the spectrum of light. It's something I knew a little bit about. I knew a lot about a little tiny pieces of it here and there, but they really brought it together for a way. They brought it together for me in a way that just totally rocked my mind.
Well, don't commit. So one of the things that we'll talk about on the follow-up also is after the dust has settled, which was your favorite episode. So we'll cover that too.
I will. You know, I'll say I love that you know, the final shots of this episode are awesome. Like, Neil ends up back on the shore where he first began his space-time odyssey, you know, and it ends with the Ship of Imagination flying away, and it's that nice, quiet shot of the Ship of Imagination with empty seat.
Yeah.
You know, where will you take it?
Yeah, beautiful.
You know, the whole series has been, like Neil saying to people, like to younger people, like I imagine, like, you know, the kids who are watching this sort of thing, learning for the first time, him saying, come with me on my journey. This is what interests me. This is what I know, what we know.
Yeah.
You know, but where will you take the Ship of Imagination? It's all yours now. And it was awesome. It was impressive. That's really all I've got to say about that. Chomber, got anything before we go?
No.
Norm?
I'm looking forward to our wrap up.
Yeah.
I'm going to process. I need some time to process.
Can we mention our special guest for the wrap up?
Sure.
So David Grinspoon will be on our finale, essentially, our wrap up for the Cosmos series. David Grinspoon's an astrologer.
Astrologer?
Sorry, not astrologer. Astronomer. He's an astrobiologist and an astronomer.
Well, he was a guest, but Chomber just called him an astrologer. So
yeah, God, I feel like it's like threatening his mother. I feel horrible. That's the worst thing I could say about the man because he's amazing.
Like, I'm a Cancer, and I knew that you were going to say that, but I didn't want to overreact like Cancers do. So
yeah.
That is Sagittarius.
But only sometimes. Other times you can hold it together. Normally I wouldn't bring it up because I don't really like the idea of idolization of anyone in the public.
Right.
But I think it'll be great to have David on because David was a close personal friend with Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
So having him reflect on Cosmos in a context, I think, is a little more personal.
It's going to be a real treat.
Right. It's a huge treat.
We got to have our act together for that one, boys. That's going to be a tribute to the whole series. And we'll be talking with someone who, you know, won't hesitate to cut us down if we make a mistake.
Yeah, exactly. Which is good. I like that.
I like it too.
You make it sound like it's Mile High Sanity Project Thunderdome.
Well, that wouldn't be a bad show. Like three idiots interviewing smart people and just getting corrected. I think that's a great show.
Three moderately intelligent stooges. All right, folks. Again, Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, reviews. Give them to us. Give us the reviews. And feedback. We like it. Follow us out there. We'll follow you out there. thank you for listening. Thank you for coming with us on our review of Neil's little tiny, space-time odyssey through our cosmos. It's been fun, and we're not done yet. A little bit more to go. So from all of us here to you out there in podcast land, please think responsibly.
Speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. The Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There is nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate. Visit? Yes. Settle? Not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known.